You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko max toku ingoa, no mai haere mai, ki te wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ra for Wednesday. I'm your host Max and I'll be with you for the next hour. Whai Akine coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez March about the National Party's newly announced KiwiSaver policy, the Green Party's reaction to the COP30 climate summit, as well as their reaction to the government choosing to halt new prescriptions for puberty blockers for young people with gender dysphoria. Following on from this, I also spoke with Robert McCulloch, the Matthew S. Able Chair of Macroeconomics and Professor in the Faculty of Business and Economics at the University of Auckland, to discuss the National Party's new KiwiSaver policy. Producer Castor spoke to James Russell, a Professor of Conservation Biology at the University of Auckland, about the government considering adding feral cats to the Predator-Free 2050 list. News and Editorial Director Joel spoke to Aaron Hendry, the General Manager and Co-Founder of Kickback, about an open letter they have signed over the government's proposed policy to ban rough sleeping in Auckland CBD. He aho o whakaaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Toku patohi mai, text in on 5395. Kaua e wareware e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō. Hei pakeheri rokiroki mā runga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
On Monday, Prime Minister Christopher Luxon announced a new National Party KiwiSaver policy, where they're looking to further increase the default KiwiSaver contribution rate. Luxon said if re-elected, National would continue to gradually increase the default contribution rates by 0.5% per year until 2032, when both employees and employers would pay 6% each. The government also announced that New Zealand would become the latest country to halt new prescriptions for puberty blockers for young people with gender dysphoria. In response to this, Ricardo Menendez March told RNZ that the government was buying into imported culture wars. And last week saw the end of the COP30 climate summit. One of the major outcomes of the summit was that more than 80 countries, including the United Kingdom and Pacific Island nations, signed a roadmap to phase out fossil fuels, but New Zealand chose not to. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke to MP Ricardo Menendez March about the Green Party's reaction to the COP30 summit, as well as their thoughts on the government's decision to halt new prescriptions of puberty blockers for young people with gender dysphoria. But first, we started with National's new KiwiSaver policy. To start off, what is the Green Party's reaction to the new KiwiSaver policy announced by National?
The main concern that we have is that without adequately addressing issues around wealth and income inequality, if you're a low-income worker, you may be considering whether the greater contributions are worth it if you can't even survive week to week. And so increasing contributions without addressing poverty puts low-income workers in a position where they just simply don't see themselves being able to save up for their retirement because they're having to pay those weekly costs. And so this policy at this point will likely only benefit those that are already comfortable enough to put that money aside.
Is this a realistic ask for employees given the current cost of living crisis?
For low-income people, it's a big ask. And this is why, while we're not against looking at the government, employers, and employee contributions, the reality is that if we're serious about supporting people to get to 65 with savings and with the safety net that they deserve, like access to good homes, and good health, etc., we need to focus on addressing the big cost of living expenses that people are facing right now, like rent, like the cost of transport, like the cost of healthcare, which is what the Greens are fighting for so that people can get to retirement with a decent enough safety net.
Are you saying then that the Greens would likely make tweaks to the policy rather than scrap it completely?
What we're focusing on is ensuring that people can have access to things like free GPs, access to affordable rentals, enough public housing, and affordable public transport so that people can then put that money aside for their retirement, as opposed to, for example, having to opt out of KiwiSaver so that you can actually make ends meet. Or in the case that we are seeing more and more recently, more people having to make hardship withdrawals of their KiwiSavers because they just simply don't have any savings if they, for example, face an unexpected health issue or just unexpected costs in their life, because we've got so many people living week to week, and this is why the government's policy just ignores low-income people's lived realities.
Luxon's goal is to eventually match the Australian rate of 12% by 2032. Are Luxon's comparisons between New Zealand and Australia here a fair comparison or goal?
Well, Australia does have a capital gains tax of some sort, and I think also Australia has, in at least its major urban centres, better invested in things like public transport that is also affordable in many cases. What we are seeing right now is a government that has made life more expensive and harder for everyday people while asking them to contribute more for their retirement, when he needs to realize that if people can't make ends meet for those weekly costs, saving up for retirement becomes a luxury rather than a thing that people can see themselves being able to do.
All right, moving on to the next topic. The COP30 Climate Summit officially ended on Friday last week. One of the outcomes of the summit was that more than 80 countries, including the UK and Pacific Island nations, signed a roadmap to phase out fossil fuels, but New Zealand chose not to. My next question is, what did the Green Party make of the outcomes of this year's COP30 Climate Summit?
No pun intended, but this is a cop-out from COP30's commitments to actually address our climate emissions. And you know, whether the government has previously said that, you know, their goal is to transition away from fossil fuels, the reality is that we're doing neither of the things that people were supposed to commit at COP30 or our even internal emissions targets. And that is because we've got a government that is caving to the fossil fuel industry. And instead of investing into things like interregional rail that allows us to have better options and more climate-friendly options when it comes to our transport emissions. These are the things that we're fighting for so that we can genuinely phase out fossil fuels from our economy.
Simon Watts, the Minister for Climate Change of New Zealand, explained that New Zealand didn't sign the roadmap to phase out fossil fuels as it had already committed to transition away from them 2 years ago. Is that a fair comment?
No, it's a full-on cop-out, and all well and fine for him to have said that we committed to that 2 years ago, when what the government is doing time and time again is pouring fuel into the climate crisis's fire. And we're seeing this with the opening of new coal mines. Instead of investing into renewable energy at pace, as well as investing on things like interregional rail and city rail to the degree that we need it, so that we can lower transport emissions, but also give people more options to get around to work, to school, in a much more faster and affordable way, while helping people who still need to use cars to get around.
More than 80 countries pushed for explicit language on phasing out oil, coal and gas, but the summit ended without any mention of cutting fossil fuels. Are you happy with that outcome?
No, I think we need global powers to be stepping up when it comes to facing one of the biggest crises of generation, which is climate change. The reality is that climate change is a cost of living issue. Life will become more expensive the more frequent and extreme weather events that we end up seeing. We saw it with the costs that the Auckland floods in 2023 had for our communities, and we risk seeing more of those events at a more frequent scale if our country and others don't do enough to transition and stop relying on fossil fuels while investing on things like rail, energy-efficient public housing, the things that actually also make people's lives easier.
Aotearoa New Zealand won Fossil of the Day for the fourth time in 5 years, although the minister says that the award is not serious. What's your view of that?
Well, independent of the minister's view, it's a signal that our government isn't doing enough to tackle the climate crisis. And we've seen it again when with the government's transport projects, which will likely increase emissions and not invest in public transport to the degree that we need it. We're seeing it with the government focusing its energy on more fossil fuel exploration as opposed to actually investing in renewables at pace. We're seeing it with the government cancelling kāinga ora homes that would have supported homeless people and also would have provided an opportunity to create more energy efficient homes. It's no surprise that the world is turning to us and realising that we talk big game at the international stage and spout all these progressive values, but at home we have a government that is leading us with climate denialist anti-science rhetoric and policy.
If the Green Party had influence over New Zealand's position, what would change at the next climate summit?
I would hope that global leaders will see us committing to doing enough to tackle our climate emissions, but they would also see a government that has adequately committed to investing in things like interregional rail, into more affordable public transport, into energy-efficient homes so that people do not face high electricity bills because their homes are built to ensure that they're warm and dry over winter. These are the things that we want to prioritize and invest in, which will make the cost of living a lot easier for people while also reducing climate change emissions.
Okay, moving on to the last topic. New Zealand has become the latest country to announce that it will halt new prescriptions for puberty blockers for young people with gender dysphoria. In response to this, you told RNZ that the government was buying into imported culture wars. Firstly, can you explain what you mean by this statement and what's the overall Green Party response to this move?
Well, when we say that they're buying into imported culture wars, we mean that the government is moving ahead by effectively having politicians prescribe health policy that is not necessarily in line with the clinical guidelines that we have had developed by clinicians over time. And I think when it comes to puberty blockers, the government has created moral panic over an issue where clinicians have tried to deal with in a really, really sensitive matter because they acknowledge the importance that these forms of healthcare have when it comes to the well-being of trans youth. People's well-being and lives are on the line as a result of this change, and the Greens will revert it and ensure that clinicians are able to adequately develop good clinical guidelines and the resources that trans youth and parents need to make informed decisions.
Do you think that the timing here was deliberate?
Well, doing it on the eve of Trans Day of Remembrance just feels like a kick in the gut for queer people across the country who are already struggling to have access to adequate healthcare, adequate housing, and a government that treats them with respect and dignity. And so this is why the latest change is extremely concerning, because it does not even follow in line with the brief that the government received from the Ministry of Health, which adequately talked about how the lack of research on puberty blockers is not an anomaly, but it's quite in line with the reality that across medical issues that affect young people, we don't tend to have a huge amount of research on it because there are issues that affect children, so it's a lot harder to do research on. But that does not mean that clinicians cannot develop amongst themselves good evidence-based, patient-centered clinical guidelines to ensure that we can push for the best outcomes for people, and in this case, trans youth. And they're singling out one specific area of medicine, and actually across all areas of medicine that affect children, we know that clinical guidelines developed by practitioners is the best way to go.
Health Minister Simeon Brown said the changes are about ensuring treatments are safe and carefully managed, and that it would give families confidence that any treatment was in the best interests of the young person. Is the government overstating uncertainty here?
I think the government seems to think that they know better than clinicians who have come out and pushed against this policy. And we have heard from clinicians who have long-standing experience on the issue that the best way to ensure that trans youth have the healthcare they need and to ensure that parents are adequately informed is by having strong clinical guidelines, strong resources that can go out to the community so that people can understand the impacts of puberty blockers. And it feels to me that the government is very specifically targeting trans youth when puberty blockers are also used for a range of other medical interventions, and singling out gender dysphoria, as the government has done, ignores the reality that puberty blockers are used for a range of issues. This is not a science and clinicians-led approach to policymaking. It's government overreach and an affront to the rights of trans people to have access to healthcare.
Lastly, do you think the government have put enough consideration into the mental health consequences of this change?
they absolutely do not seem to care about the healthcare of trans people more broadly. And at a time where we're facing really serious issues in our health system, like staffing shortages in our hospitals, people not being able to access a GP for basic things, that means that they end up in hospital due to preventable conditions. It feels bizarre to have a government that would rather attack trans people and cause culture wars that end up distracting from the really serious issues that our health system faces. And this is why the Greens will be focusing on ensuring that we can deliver a healthcare system that works for everyone instead of buying into these cultural wars while our health system ends up crumbling due to inadequate investment and support to our staff.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March on the National Party's new KiwiSaver policy announcement, the COP30 climate summit, and the government's decision to halt new prescriptions of puberty blockers for young people with gender dysphoria.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
Following our discussion with the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, we decided to further break down the National Party's new KiwiSaver policy with Robert McCulloch, the Matthew S. Abel Chair of Macroeconomics and Professor in the Faculty of Business and Economics at the University of Auckland. Here's what he thought about the newly announced policy by National. Luxon is aiming to match the Australians with this policy, but you've stated that National's version is much weaker than Australia's. Can you explain why?
Yes. Well, Luxon announced is unworkable, and it hasn't been thought through. It was a comms announcement. It has no economic content whatsoever. And the reason for that is the two systems, Australia's and New Zealand's, are completely different. Australia has a compulsory scheme. The whole of Australia is in that scheme. Employers pay 12%. In New Zealand, around a fifth of the population aren't even in KiwiSaver. And of the ones who are aged between 18 and 65, around 10 to 15% aren't even contributing. So you've got around a third of this nation aren't actually contributing anything to KiwiSaver. So you can't announce a scheme like he has, where you're going to dramatically increase contributions when a third of the country can't afford to pay anything into it. They just don't have the money to pay. So it's an unworkable scheme as he announced it. The way you got to do it, I wrote a bunch of papers on this over the last decade, is should you wish people to contribute more, you have to accompany that with tax cuts for low-income earners so that their disposable income doesn't drop. You've got to help them get them into KiwiSaver. That may involve a subsidy, a wealth transfer from rich to poor. The Aussies put the burden entirely on the employer as well, but also accompanied it with corporate tax cuts. So it's quite a complicated thing. Paul Keating spent years of his life working on this in Australia. It's not straightforward. You've got to combine the sort of savings reform with tax reform as well. So what Luxon announced was purely marketing. It was comms. It was an absolute load of hogwash. There's nothing in it at all. There's no economic content whatsoever to what Lux announced. It was a political motive behind it because he's scared that the Labor and NZ First may be moving on savings and he isn't. But I think the time in New Zealand has got to stop when politicians are just doing PR comms and marketing announcements. I mean, Christopher Luxon used to work at Unilever. His job was marketing, selling products and branding. You can't run a country thinking that you go on TV and do a Unilever-style marketing campaign like you're releasing a new product. He's actually messing with people's lives and their livelihoods. You shouldn't just reduce it to a kind of PR marketing announcement.
Why do you think this policy doesn't help low-income workers?
Well, because a huge chunk of them aren't in KiwiSaver. So around a fifth of them aren't even in it. They can't afford to contribute. They can't come up. Families who are struggling to pay the bills can't then sequester quite a large chunk of their income to put in a savings account. They can't afford it. They need the money now. So you have to design a system where you can bring them in, and either the employer pays or you give that family tax relief or help. And you do have to bring them into it. You can't run a nation where a third of the country is not in the country's in its flagship savings scheme. Otherwise, you know, Lux was saying, well, a 21-year-old will retire with over a million. What, he wants half the country to have over a million and half the country to have nothing? And in poverty, he would explode inequality. You have to bring the whole nation with you. Everyone's got to be part of it. His scheme is just a complete load of bunkum. But really, I mean it very seriously. He cannot play games with people's lives where you release a policy where you haven't given any thought as to how you can bring a third of the population into the scheme. You can't leave behind so many people. It's like saying a third of the country can't go to hospital for healthcare. We're going to leave behind a third of the country. It's unacceptable what he announced. I'm surprised the mainstream media aren't querying him more about it, because there's no economic content to what he announced.
One question I have with this, along with the other ones, is what's stopping employers from just lowering salary rates to adjust for the increased KiwiSaver contribution?
Well, yes, it's a good question, and it's come up a bit from the accountants, this idea of, what do they call it, full remuneration packages. That issue has been long studied in economics. It's called sort of the pass-through, how much of the employer's increased contribution, payroll tax, will be passed on to the employee. And there are dozens of articles in economics which have estimated that. It turns out to be an empirical question. It varies greatly in countries. Sometimes they pass on a lot of it, sometimes very little of it. And it depends on a lot of factors. You get into quite difficult economics on how the labour market works. I mean, an employer can say, well, we're going to try to say to an employer, well, should we have to pay 6% or 12%? We're going to cut your wage by 12%. Well, they can try it, but an employee might say, well, screw you, I'm not going to work for you, I'll work for someone else who's not going to pass it on. So, you know, there are issues like the competitiveness of the labour market, whether labour can reject those sort of offers. So there are a whole lot of factors which determine how much employers can pass on. So it's not up to the employer. They don't have full power with that, because they may turn away employees, you see. So, you know, when it's a competitive market for labour, you know, that it's not obvious they can always do that.
But don't you think that the power is with them right now because of the lack of jobs, that, you know, employees can't just say, I'll go work for someone else, because there might not be someone else to work for?
Could be, yeah. The power can change like that. And, you know, an employee may be forced to accept a lower wage. By the way, to the extent that you're right, so it could well happen, and a lot of articles in economics say quite a chunk of it is passed on. They have these quite high payroll taxes, they call them in Europe, and there's an argument that in many of the countries, as you say, a chunk of it has been passed on. Now, the way in the articles that on reform of the saving system that I did, the way we dealt with that was simply giving lower wage workers tax relief, a tax cut to give them more disposable income that way. So the government may well have to help low-income workers with transfers or with tax relief to account for that factor, should employers try to reduce their wage in that way. So you're right, that the government may well have to give them assistance or give them a transfer, give them a tax relief, to the extent that employers start doing that and take advantage of weak labour.
Do you think then that the Nationals' plan needs tweaks or a complete overhaul?
It's a bunkum plan. It's not a matter of tweaking it. It hasn't been thought out. I don't take it seriously at all. It's not economics. What they released was not economics at all. I mean, I've spent 30 or 40 years on the subject. I've spent 10 years working on this issue with a former finance minister of New Zealand who actually introduced the first compulsory savings scheme in the country. The plan is, it's not a plan, it's just Lux I think it's actually quite disturbing to have a prime minister who thinks he's still working for Unilever and he's rolling out a new brand of washing detergent, and he just comes up with a good marketing line. This isn't a policy. This is just a sort of advertising gimmick. There's nothing in the policy. You know, when you have a third of the country who can't afford to contribute, and he's saying we're going to ramp up those contributions, people can't make them. They can't afford to make them at all. And he's leaving behind a third of the country. You have to bring the whole country with you. In the articles that I did on it, you have to combine this reform to the extent, like you say, employers are going to pass on some of their extra contributions. You have to give tax relief, assistance, transfers to low-income earners to help them into the system. And that involves a fiscal reform, a tax reform that has to go hand in hand with the KiwiSaver reform. You've got to help low-income earners into it. None of that's been thought out. I know that for a fact because I know folks in the Beehive, in his office. I know his chief policy advisors, and none of that has been thought out at all. This is just a political comms announcement. But I think when you're playing with people's lives and you're playing with the lives of a third of the country, the low earners who can't afford to get by, and you're coming up with this line that, oh, well, just they can give up a whole extra chunk of their income, and it'll be a wonderful thing. They'll all be millionaires when they're 65. No, no, they won't. They're not even in KiwiSaver. And a chunk of them are in it aren't even contributing because they're suffering hardship. So it's not a plan. It's actually a comm job.
And that was Robert McCulloch from the University of Auckland on why he finds National's new KiwiSaver policy disturbing. We'll be right back after this short break.
95 BFM Drive Island at the Bay Spot Morningside with Crystal Chen and Joe Captain, Friday, November 28th from 4 to 7 p.m.
Tunes, pints and the folks from your fave radio station? What more could you want on a sunny Friday arvo? So cruise down and enjoy some jazzy tunes from the talented Crystal Chen and the prolific Joe Captain.
Drive Island at the Bay Spot Morningside from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, November 28th. Thanks to McLeod's and NZ On Air.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
What if you call it?
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95 BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95 BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Garth! Garth! Where's your hat? No hat, no play.
I don't have one, sir.
Then go on and pick a hat from Lost Property.
Oh, sir, those hats all have nits.
It's nits or melanoma, Garth.
It's a no hat, no play summer, so it's lucky 95 BFM have you sorted with sweet merch for your noggins. Choose from four designs, two classic cap designs, one cord design, and a bucket hat. Pre-order yours now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
So, which way is it?
The other's way.
Sorry, which direction?
Just go the other's way.
Okay, so left, right?
Other's way. You can't go wrong.
Left, right, front or back. Every direction is a good choice at the Other's Way Festival. And 95 BFM have a single pass to the main stage to give away. So stay tuned to breakfast for your chance to win. Only if you have a B card though.
95 BFM presents The Other's Way, Saturday, November 29th. Tickets available now from Moshtix.
The original originator.
95 BFM. Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device. Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
because that's the big deal here. Dolphin orgies.
The Wire.
Last week, Conservation Minister Tama Pōtaka announced plans to add feral cats to the government's list of pests to be eradicated by 2050. The decision follows a campaign promise from Prime Minister Christopher Luxon made in a debate in 2023. Feral cats pose numerous wildlife risks when compared to other predators such as rats or stoats. In addition, their larger size makes trapping more difficult, meaning new techniques will need to be developed. To discuss the change, why it's important, and how it fits in with the larger predator-free 2050 mission, producer Castor spoke to Professor of Conservation Biology at the University of Auckland, James Russell.
What's the difference when we're classifying between feral and stray cats?
There's different ways you can consider how we classify cats. One of them is kind of where they are and how they behave, and for that we kind of have feral cats at one end, pet cats at the other, and stray cats existing in this ambiguous area in between. Another one might be just whether you consider if this cat has an owner or not, or someone that will take responsibility for that. So in that regards, we have feral cats out in the wild and then pet cats that someone owns. And ultimately what we're worried about is the impact these cats have. So any cat with teeth and claws can go out and kill birds or reptiles, and for some cats that just depends on their behaviour. But certainly all feral cats in the wild without an owner are likely to go out and be catching a bird or a reptile, and that's really what we want to cut back on. We want to make sure cats of any kind are not having an impact on biodiversity, but certainly we know all feral cats are having an impact on biodiversity.
And what kind of dangers exactly do feral cats pose, especially like compared to other predators we see in Aotearoa?
Feral cats are a really voracious predator, so they do what's called surplus killing. So they can go out there and they don't just kill an animal that they need to eat, but they kill many animals because they're a top predator and they really, really enjoy it. But at the same time, they're a valued companion animal, and so that's why they've sort of been in the in-between basket, where because of their impacts we want to manage them as part of making New Zealand predator free, but on the other hand we don't want to be removing all cats from New Zealand, and we also want to make sure we have the tools and the ability to manage them. So whereas the previous predators that have been part of predator free New Zealand, the stoats, the rats and the possums, we know their impacts are widespread. We know that they're not pet animals for many people except for some pet rats. And we know that they are present all across New Zealand. Feral cats are ones where their areas where they impact in New Zealand are quite specific, so only certain areas of New Zealand. So that's why until now there's been a hesitancy about including them. But as we move to more and more areas having rats and stoats and possums managed, we're now seeing these impacts of predator cats, feral cats, be higher.
You mentioned also that it's not just feral cats that have an impact on bird populations. It'll be other cats like house cats and pet cats also there. Obviously, those probably won't get added to the predator-free list. But are there things we can do to, I guess, reduce the impact of house cats, pet cats on our biodiversity here?
Absolutely. I'm a cat person myself, and so when I have cats, that I want to keep them indoors. I want to make sure they've got bells around their neck. I want to make sure they don't get to go out at night when birds are much more defenceless for them. So it's just being a responsible cat owner, and in particular getting your cat microchipped would be a really key thing, as groups are doing cat management, and that can encroach quite closer to where pet cats are. They might use non-lethal methods such as live trapping. If your pet cat ends up in one of those live traps, you want to make sure they scan it and see that it's your pet and can bring it back to you promptly and just find out why it might have been roaming.
A lot of people, you know, think that cats are very useful for controlling rat populations. Is that true? You know, can cats provide a benefit for our conservation efforts?
There is a widespread misconception that cats actually control rats and mice and they might actually be helping birds. And I've done a number of studies myself, as well as many others, that show that's not the case. Obviously, if it were the case, the introduction of cats would have been really beneficial when they first introduced them to control rats. But we know that's not the case. And what cats actually do is they tend to scare rats and mice away. So although having a cat in your house means you don't see rats or mice anymore, it's not because the cats actually controlled them. It's because those rats and mice have been scared outside your house, where they're probably up in the tops of trees eating even more birds' eggs in the nests. And so although cats scare the rats away and stop them being a problem for humans, they don't actually solve the conservation problem of rats and mice. So instead now you just have mice and rats and cats eating the birds. And so it is important that we make sure that these cats are managed alongside the rats and mice. And as we know from conservation work on islands around New Zealand, the best solution for the maximum conservation gains is to remove as many of these predators as possible, just so that you don't get any surprise unexpected effects.
And so thinking now more broadly, I mean, how does this change fit? You know, our government's done some things towards conservation. Does this fit with the broader picture?
We're very lucky in New Zealand, I think, that there's broad support across the political spectrum, bipartisan support for predator control. So we're really seeing the benefits of that occurring across the country more and more projects are achieving and sustaining the goals of predator elimination. Adding in cats to the mix adds a little bit more complexity. What we do have to be aware of is that Predator Free New Zealand is not the New Zealand conservation strategy. There's other threats such as invasive wasps and invasive plants and invasive freshwater species and other threats that aren't even invasive species. They can just be climate change and pollution. We'll continue to manage all of those threats. But the Predator Free goal is really about targeting particular invasive mammalian predators that we can realistically remove from the entirety of the country. So at different sites, people are definitely targeting those species, of which, as well as the rats, the stoats and the possums, cats will now be added, but they're welcome to target other species such as hedgehogs and mice where there's local biodiversity values that would benefit from those other species being managed as well. With cats, we'll have to explore some new technologies to do it, whereas we've got well-established methods for rats and stoats. For cats, we're having to look at work done in Australia, where feral cats are the number one predator, and also some pioneering work done by the Department of Conservation National Eradication Team on Auckland Island, where they have just pigs and cats and mice. So they've been developing some really new and quite funny sometimes message, like exploding kangaroo sausages that are really attractive to cats. So we're looking at these kinds of new tools, and they'll be the kinds of things that other projects will be bringing on board as we work to include cats in the Predator Free New Zealand strategy.
Yeah, and then thinking about the Predator Free strategy moving forward, obviously, I mean, it's in the name, right, Predator Free 2050. How on track are we to reach this goal by 2050 or even earlier or later?
I think 2050 is still a realistic goal and at least a point where we'd really be assessing how far we've got. But it's very difficult to kind of future gaze beyond about 10 years. And so it's timely that the New Zealand Department of Conservation as the lead agency implementing Predator Free Strategy is now coming forward with its new strategy from 2030 onwards for the next 5 years. But we're seeing some really great wins. The community's really brought into it. There's 33% solid awareness around New Zealand of the Predator Free New Zealand program. I'm down in Franz Josef at the moment today, and I've just been out to Okarito. They're the first predator-free towns in New Zealand where stoats, rats and possums have been entirely removed. And the bird life, to be honest, has just been astounding. I was in the office of Zero Invasive Predators today, and a bellbird just tried to flew into the house to have a look around, which is something I'd never experienced before. And we were out in Okarito seeing all the birds just calling in the middle of the day, a time of day when usually birds are silent. So places like this are really setting the bar for what we can achieve and showing that you can roll it out across tens of thousands of hectares. And now we're going, well, where's the next prize? Where can we expand further? Should we be heading down into Fiordland and aiming for 1 million hectares? So I think Predator Free is really gaining momentum and continuing in the right direction.
And that was James Russell from the University of Auckland on Conservation Minister Tama Potaka's announced plans to add feral cats to the government's list of pests to be eradicated by 2050. We'll be right back after this short break.
I just played the rodeo, I think I need to change. I still love the sad cowboy on someone else's stage. Crashing the car into the side. Think I'll take a makeover on someone else's dime. And the mission's not to settle. It's always all or nothing. Someone
woman's husband or the kettle, singing a song about somebody safe, singing a song from some righteous place. I'm too drunk, somebody said you cheered up. I don't feel the difference anymore. Said you kissed her, but I don't feel surrounded anymore. I can see it clearly, getting off at the same stop. He's just waiting for me to backslide right to the shop. The more too drunk, somebody said you cheated up. I don't feel the difference anymore. Bitter, somebody said you kissed her. I don't feel surrounded.
Yes, sir.
Fresh Kid P, Fresh Kid T.
Oh, yeah, we back.
Oh, and Zafoon, by the way.
Yeah, Jones. Yeah. Chitty Bang, and we pretty much amazing.
Can we hear your new song, please?
I got you.
Hey, yo, I once was a kid, all I had was a dream. More money, more problems, when I get it, I'ma pile it up. Now I'm dope, want the bread, we can toast. So fresh, how we flow, everybody get this down from us.
I once was a kid with the other little kids. Now I'm ripping up shows and them fans going wild with us. Tell mommy I'm sorry, this life is a party.
Remember
I'm never growing up.
Reminisce days of the innocence. Now it's Chitty Bang, Google me the images. Follow me, I'm the leader. And when I park cars, I don't pay for the meter. I remember I was younger as a kid, it was the best. I used to touch on all the pretty girls in recess. I'm at my peak, yes, I won't leave yet. Cereal style, cereal aisle, I need checks. I can make these rappers run like a hard drill. Rock band, show you how the guitar feel. And I could care less how y'all feel. I got a flow to make a bitch do a cartwheel. This is that good, just pump it and relax, bro. And you could get it free, don't worry about the tax, though. And Zap Fool, thank you for the crack. But I play it Ron Burgundy, I anchor on the track.
Hey,
like
yo, I once was a kid, all I had was a dream. More money, more problems, when I get it, I'ma pile it up. Now I'm dope, want the bread, we get toast. So fresh, how we flow, everybody get this down from us.
I once was a kid with the other little kids. Now I'm ripping up shows and them fans going wild with us. Tell mommy I'm sorry, this life is a party. I'm never growing up.
Can I please get a little bit of knowledge? Somebody tell Roth that I don't love college. Cause the real world's kinda like real world. And it's drama, so you are Svetlana. And I'm just a rhymer, swimming in the water, trying to dodge the piranha and fly to Bahamas. Pretty little mama, chitty in the spot where you at, Pearl Lady. Show me what you got. They say, why you rapping for the kids for? I say my clothes come fitted, the lid store. This summer you can catch me on a big tour. I'm high grade, I think they need to quiz more. And let me get with you, don't let the kid hit you. I'm the photo album Valletta has, big picture. The rule is, the dude is, so up, so Chuck, I'm a cool kid.
Hey, yo, I once was a kid, all I had was a dream. More money, more problems, when I get it, I'ma pile it up. Now I'm dope, want the bread, we get toast, so fresh. How we flow, everybody get this down. Hey, yo, I once was a kid with the other little kids. Now I'm ripping up shows and the fans going wild with us. Tell mommy I'm sorry, this life is a party. I'm not a pro. Hey, I once was a kid, all I had was a dream. More money, more problems, when I get it, I'ma pile it up. Now I'm dope, want the bread, we get toast, so fresh. How we flow, everybody get this down. Hey, yo, I once was a kid with the other little kids. Now I'm ripping up shows and the fans going wild with us. Tell mommy I'm sorry, this life is a party. I'm never growing up.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. And if you miss the name of the predator-free towns or areas, you can always go back on the 95BFM website after the show and listen to the podcasted versions. Action Station Aotearoa Kickback and over 40 opposition leaders, community leaders and organizations launched an open letter on Monday regarding the government's potential policy to ban rough sleeping in Auckland CBD. The proposed ban, despite the proposal being in its early stages of discussions, has been heavily condemned across the sector and has raised the question of where those rough sleeping people would go. News and editorial director Joel spoke to Aaron Hendry, the general manager and co-founder of Kickback, a youth development organisation responding to homelessness, about this open letter.
As a bit of a recap, what is the government's potential ban on rough sleeping and how did it come about?
Yeah, look, the government has made it known that they are looking at introducing move-on orders, which would essentially, you know, criminalise and ban whānau from sleeping rough in the city centre. It's really concerning in that what it'll do is drive people out of the city centre into the suburbs, into places where they can't access that support or where they're more vulnerable and at risk of exploitation and abuse. And also, people will end up experiencing homelessness for much longer than they needed to because they just won't be able to access the support they need. There's a real reason why people come into the city centre. There's a level of safety and community that exists in the city centre, and there's also access to support. And so, you know, there's a real opportunity to connect with people swiftly and give them access to that support if that is resourced well. But yeah, the government has decided that they would like to, as they say, clean up the street, which is essentially meaning punishing people who do not have access to safe and stable housing and pushing them further and further away from the support that they need. First, we need to acknowledge why people are sleeping outside in Auckland city centre at the moment. The reality is we have a crisis of homelessness that's escalating across the country. Look, it's been going on for a long time, but over these last couple of years, the government has made some really clear political decisions that have escalated that crisis and directly impacted people and meant that they have had nowhere else to go but our streets. For example, the government's decisions to make it harder to access emergency housing has literally meant that people have walked into work and income, have been denied access to shelter, have walked out again and slept on the streets on Queen Street, right? So that is a very clear decision the government's made that has impacted this situation we're dealing with at the moment. So the real solution here, fundamentally, it's housing. It's ensuring that people have safe, stable housing and they have access to it. And it's also that we provide people with immediate access to shelter so that when people walk into work and income, they're not denied that support and they don't have to sleep outside. In terms of what resources are out there, look, the community is doing everything they can. I see a lot of mahi that is happening across our city to really support our whānau and our people, but there is a real lack of resource to really deal with the size and scope of the issue. And pushing people out into the suburbs often means that people go into forgotten alleys, they go into spaces where they're not seen, where they're not getting the support they need. In the city centre, there's a real opportunity to connect with people really, really quickly and get them access to the support that they require. You know, a little example from Kickback, what we're seeing, at least about 50% of all the young people that come to us that we end up getting supporting come to the Auckland Central before they connect with us. They've come to Auckland Central because that is a space where they recognise they're going to get some form of support or safety in community that is there. And so the opportunity for us is we are able to connect really swiftly, sometimes within an hour of receiving a referral. We're able to get a young person off the street into some form of shelter and then provide wraparound support to that young person. And that is the opportunity the government could be looking at. How do we provide, you know, swift access to support and swift access to shelter? And there's a lot of these solutions out there.
That leads on to a little bit of my next question, but how have those at Kickback, which is an organization catering to vulnerable young people, how have those residing or being supported by Kickback reacted to this proposed policy?
People are frustrated, angry. You know, I've had a young person speak to me recently and say, look, they feel like the Prime Minister is bullying them. You know, that a lot of the policies directed at young people and people who are unhoused feel like bullying to them from our Prime Minister, from our ministers. That's really heartbreaking that our young people are absorbing that message from these sorts of policies. Our rangatahi know that it's not their fault that they are sleeping outside. It's the fault of, you know, political decisions and political leaders who are not valuing the lives of our people over, you know, the financial interests of those who have wealth in this country. And, you know, that's really disappointing. It's also disappointing because it is extremely preventable, homelessness, youth homelessness. We have solutions. We can be addressing this crisis, but punishing people who are unhoused is not the way forward.
This open letter has been signed by a variety of Auckland-based MPs, local board members, councillors, union and community organisations. Who are some of these figures and groups?
Yeah, look, it's a real strong united front from Aucklanders and community leaders, you know, people like the Mental Health Foundation, unions, you know, Auckland MPs, local boards, legal representatives. You know, there is a real wide range of support here. And basically the message is that, you know, Aucklanders, those who serve our communities, are concerned about this ban and want to bin it. We need to ensure that we are actually supporting people, not punishing them for being in a situation that they have no control over.
You've touched on this throughout the interview, but what does the open letter specifically call for?
Well, the open letter is specifically calling for, one, to bin the ban, to make sure that we scrap that piece of legislation and that we put forward real solutions. So, look, there's really things that the government could be doing right now. One is implement duty to assist legislation. So a law that would mean that the state's obligation is clarified. So if someone walks into Work and Income, they should not be denied support and be left to turned out onto the street. They should be provided with instant access to that support. Duty to assist legislation would ensure that the state provides the support that they are required to people, to our whānau, when they need it. But we could be resourcing immediate housing services. There's services like this already operating in the city. Kahu Te Kaha do an amazing service out south that provides youth access to immediate accommodation. The Kickback's working with Massey Community Trust on the Safety Net Project Network, which also provides immediate access to accommodation for those who need it. So but the government could be scaling these sorts of models and supporting them across the city and across the country. The government also could be investing in outreach crisis support services for whānau so that we can connect with people swiftly and get them the support that they need and the advocacy they need to get into housing. But fundamentally, homelessness is a housing problem. The government needs to commit to providing public housing and scaling up public housing so that we can access housing when we need it.
And how can people support this kaupapa?
What you can be doing right now is emailing the Prime Minister, emailing the ministers involved, and be really clear. We need action on this. We need to ensure that we are responding to the homelessness crisis and supporting whānau, not punishing people. Aucklanders need to let our government know that this is not supported by the community and it needs to be binned.
That was Kickback's Aaron Hendry on an open letter expressing concerns over the government's potential homelessness ban in Auckland's CBD.
That was The Wire.
Koe rā te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, Robert McCulloch, the Matthew S. Abel Chair of Macroeconomics and Professor in the Faculty of Business and Economics at the University of Auckland, Aaron Hendry, the General Manager and Co-Founder of Kickback, as well as Professor of Conservation Biology at the University of Auckland, James Russell. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in to 95BFM. Next up is the Wednesday 1-4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.